On the 8th of December 1941, the 7th of December in Pearl Harbor across the international dateline, the Japanese finally launched full-scale war across Asia and the Pacific. In 1937, Japan had invaded eastern China in an undeclared war of terrible savagery, swallowing up all of the important cities along the coast, from Beijing in the north to Guangzhou in the south. The British and the other Western powers still clung to their many small trading concessions and enclaves along the China coast, the most important being the international settlement in Shanghai. But it was clear that it was only a matter of time before the Japanese struck at the European powers as well. Britain had aided this process by withdrawing her forces from northern China in 1940, the US maintaining a single battalion of Marines in Shanghai, along with a single gunboat from the Royal and US Navies. As Japanese carrier planes crippled the US Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor, other Japanese forces struck at Shanghai, sweeping aside a brave but futile last stand by the gunboat HMS Petrel, and also landed in southern Thailand and northern Malaya, aiming to capture Singapore. Yet more Japanese forces would strike at Burma and the Philippines, as well as the oil-rich Dutch East Indies, now Indonesia. Everywhere, Allied forces reeled under the onslaught. But there was one place in China that the Japanese couldn't take quite so easily as Shanghai, and that was the British Crown Colony of Hong Kong. European Shanghai had been swept away in one day, but Hong Kong would prove to be a much tougher nut for the Japanese to crack. But the colony soon found itself in the vice-like grip of the immensely powerful Japanese military in China until its defences were crushed and eventually completely extinguished. The British commander in Hong Kong, 50-year-old Major General Christopher Maltby, was handed an almost impossible task when his superior, Air Chief Marshal Sir Robert Brooke Popham, who was responsible for all British forces in the Far East, ordered him to stand firm against a Japanese invasion. Maltby could draw upon a mere handful of regular troops to carry out his task, a mixture of British, Indian and Canadian battalions, with some local volunteer and Chinese units thrown in. Maltby had arrived in Hong Kong in 1940, fresh from commanding a brigade in India, and his posting had coincided with the British decision to wind up North China Command, withdrawing the three battalions from Shanghai and Tianjin, and effectively abandoning the international settlement to its fate. Press reports noted that Maltby was known to be, quote, always cool and completely unruffled, and has a quiet sense of humour and tremendous powers of endurance, unquote. These qualities would be extremely useful over the coming weeks. Maltby had nowhere near enough experienced soldiers and equipment to make a stand in Hong Kong militarily viable. Those in London were fully aware of his predicament and were, as yet, undecided on how to help him. The fact that Maltby had any forces at all with which to defend Hong Kong was only because of a dramatic government U-turn in Whitehall that occurred after considerable wrangling and argument. With the disbandment of North China Command in late 1940, the government also decided to reduce the troop levels that made up the Hong Kong garrison to just two British infantry battalions, whose roles were to be guarding the border with China and working with the Hong Kong police in the maintenance of internal order. If, or rather when, the Japanese attack came, these two battalions could not have done much except surrender. It was the direct intervention of Air Chief Marshal Brooke Popham that caused a change in British policy. Brooke Popham argued that a limited reinforcement of Hong Kong would allow Maltby and the garrison to delay any Japanese attack, gaining time for the British to be reinforced elsewhere in Asia. A limited reinforcement would prevent Maltby from being forced into an early and humiliating capitulation that would damage imperial prestige at home and abroad. To mount a proper defence of Hong Kong, the army suggested that at least 6 full infantry brigades would have been required, equating to 18 infantry battalions. This was immediately rejected. Instead, Brooke Popham believed that two brigades, totaling six battalions, could impose a sufficient delay on the Japanese to fulfill his strategic plans for the region. Maltby was told, in no uncertain terms by London, to fight on for as long as possible before surrendering, and to expect no relief. It was to be a last stand with no hope of escape. Maltby attacked the problem of how to complete his almost suicidal instructions with a dogged determination. He would make the Japanese pay for every inch of the colony before raising a white flag. He had two regular, though understrength, British battalions that had recently been withdrawn from Shanghai, the 2nd Battalion Royal Scots and 1st Battalion Middlesex Regiment, the latter re-rolled as a machine gun battalion. Canada had rushed two completely inexperienced infantry battalions to Hong Kong as their imperial contribution to the Far Eastern War, 1st Battalion Winnipeg Grenadiers and the 1st Battalion the Royal Rifles of Canada. These men were completely unprepared for the horrors to come. "How innocent of combat we were, how naive of the horrors of war," recalled Private Phil Doddridge of the Royal Rifles of Canada. "How far removed from the comforts of home and the good order of Canada," he said. There were also two Indian Army battalions stationed in the city, mainly composed of reservists, the 5th Battalion, the 7th Rajput Regiment, and the 2nd Battalion, 14th Punjabis. The British also had several artillery and engineer units, along with the usual supporting and ancillary services. Aiding the regulars were other colonial and volunteer formations, consisting of the locally raised 1 battalion strong Hong Kong Chinese Regiment, 2 mountain batteries, and 3 medium batteries of the mostly Indian manned Hong Kong and Singapore Royal Artillery, the HK and SRA, and the Hong Kong Volunteer Defence Corps, the HKVDC, an infantry unit that amounted to a battalion group made up of bankers, merchants and businessmen of British origin who were living in the colony. These volunteers would fight like lions alongside the regulars and suffer huge casualties in the process. In total, Maltby had about 14,000 troops. Opposing him would be Major General Takashi Sakai's Japanese 38th Infantry Division, that numbered 50,000 battle-hardened troops, the main assault force consisting of 3 regiments, a Japanese regiment being roughly equivalent to a British brigade, that were poised along the Shamchun River, the border between mainland China and Hong Kong's new territories, a large area of land leased from Qing Dynasty China in 1898 for 99 years. Famous British battalions like the 2nd Royal Scots had deteriorated after a long period of inaction stationed in the Far East. Because of the exigencies of the European War, many of its best and most experienced NCOs, the backbone of the battalion, had been recalled to Britain to provide cadres for new emergency battalions. When the Japanese attacked, the battalion was both under strength and experiencing discipline problems. Those military forces that did remain in the colony were not on top form, as the debilitating effects of a tropical climate and an active social scene had sapped the strength of the men. At the time, Hong Kong boasted 10,000 prostitutes who worked the hundreds of bars, dance halls and brothels busily frequented by the local garrison. The 2nd Battalion Royal Scots had not seen Britain in 7 years, one soldier recalling a dance hall that had been renamed the Gonorrhea Racetrack by its patrons. Probably Maltby's best unit was the 1st Middlesex Regiment, which was in top fighting condition but had been re-rolled as a machine gun battalion rather than remaining as conventional line infantry. The British plan of defence was to slow down the Japanese advance from the border by staging a series of holding actions behind Kowloon in the mountainous New Territories. Extensive fortifications from which to mount a static defence already existed, and 2 infantry brigades were created to man them. The 11-mile-long gin drinkers line of redoubts and trench systems was the showcase British defensive position, a Far Eastern Maginot Line. Constructed in 1936-38, the Gin Drinkers Line was not a continuous fortification, but a series of strong points and bunker systems linked together by paths. The Mount Davis Battery and Stonecutters Island Fort provided artillery support. The new Mainland Brigade, under eye-patch-wearing Brigadier Cedric Wallace, would hold the Gin Drinkers Line, and it was hoped that the position, particularly the impressive Shingmun Redoubt, would check the Japanese for at least 3 weeks. 2nd Royal Scots held the west of the line, including the Shingmun Redoubt, which also housed the command headquarters. The Shingmun Redoubt consisted of 4 pillboxes mounted with Vickers and Bren machine guns, interlinked with 5-foot-deep defensive channels or trenches named after London roads. The redoubt had space for 128 soldiers, but when the Japanese assault occurred, less than half that number were present, a disastrous mistake. The 2nd and 4th Punjabis held the centre of the Gin Drinkers Line and the 5th 7th Rajputs the east. The Shingmun Redoubt was manned by 43 soldiers, drawn from the headquarters of A Company, Royal Scots, along with the battalion's No. 8 platoon supported by elements of 1 Mountain Battery, Hong Kong and Singapore Royal Artillery, all under the command of Captain Potato Jones. The press was led to believe that Hong Kong was virtually impregnable, a Canadian reporter calling the colony, quote, the rocky Far Eastern stronghold that may develop into a Tobruk of the Pacific, unquote, referring to the stand of the 14,000 men of the 9th Infantry Division under Australian Lieutenant General Leslie Morshead in holding the port fortress city of Tobruk in Libya, a battle that was still ongoing when the Japanese invaded Hong Kong. Although the press coverage exaggerated Hong Kong's defences, the Gin Drinkers Line, if it had been properly manned by experienced troops, would have posed a serious threat to the Japanese and may well have stopped their advance dead. Japanese generals were so concerned about the position that they expected their attack to be held up for at least a month, and even began to divert reinforcements from their war in China to replace the expected heavy casualties. Hong Kong Island would be defended by the 3-Battalion Island Brigade, consisting of the 1st Winnipeg Grenadiers, 1st Royal Rifles of Canada and 1st Middlesex Regiment, with the HKVDC and HKSRA in support, all under the command of another experienced British officer, newly promoted Brigadier John Lawson. The brigade was ordered to man and hold a series of hastily constructed pillboxes and gun batteries situated around the perimeter of the island. At 8 a.m. on the 8th of December 1941, the Japanese 21st, 23rd and 38th Infantry Regiments stormed across the Shamchun River using temporary bridges. The British did not attempt to hold the Japanese at the border, but the Royal Engineers did their utmost to impede the Japanese advance between the border and the river, blowing bridges and culverts until forced to retire under the covering fire of C Company, 2nd 14th Punjabis. The Indian sepoys then dug themselves in around the approaches to the village of Tai Po and waited for an advancing Japanese column to blunder straight into a carefully laid ambush. Although the Indian battalion managed to smash an infantry unit and an artillery battery before withdrawing, this victory did not impede the Japanese advance, and they recovered quickly and pressed on. Private Francis Crabb of No. 2 Machine Guns Scottish Company, Hong Kong Volunteer Defence Corps, was mobilised shortly before the Japanese invasion. He spent the 8th of December finding his way from his home in Kowloon to the Volunteer HQ on Hong Kong Island. His company comprised 100 men, 90% of whom were Scots. Quote, the companies were formed up and stores and gas masks issued, as were rifles, Lewis guns, and in my case a heavy 45 revolver, as I was a number one on a Vickers machine gun, recalled Crabb. I had never seen a revolver before, let alone fired one, and being at the time a youth of tender years, I wasn't even able to pull the trigger of this monster. Unquote. Private Crabb's unit was sent to guard against Japanese landings in Big Wave Bay. but then was switched to covering Sai Wan Bay and an artillery battery at Pak Sha Wan, alongside the Royal Rifles of Canada and the Middlesex Regiment. On the 9th of December, a reconnaissance party from the Japanese 228th Regiment discovered that the British defences at 225 High Ground near the Shingmun Redoubt were weakly held. If the Japanese seized this high ground, they could dominate all British positions to the west of the line. At 9 p.m. that evening, a lieutenant and 10 men launched a surprise night attack on the Royal Scots holding the position. Japanese combat engineers blew holes in the barbed wire apron around the redoubt and, using special charges, blew up several of the pillboxes. By 7 a.m. on the 10th of December, the position was in Japanese hands and they had taken 27 prisoners. 3 British were killed and 13 managed to escape. The gin drinkers' line had been fatally breached. Later on the 10th of December, the Japanese launched a general assault on the line and by the next day had captured Kam Shan and Tate's Cairn. By noon on the 11th, Maltby decided to withdraw his remaining forces from the line to Hong Kong Island in order to preserve the garrison. With the redoubt gone, mainland brigade fell back on the town of Kowloon before crossing over to Hong Kong Island. Initially, the Royal Scots pulled back about 2,000 yards from the gin drinkers' line onto a position on Golden Hill behind the Shingmun Redoubt. On the 11th, the advancing Japanese heavily engaged the 2 Royal Scots companies that were occupying the feature, and the hill was wrested from them. The hill contained no prepared positions, just a few shell scrapes. And because the ground was rock hard, Japanese mortar bombs exploded with devastating consequences, causing heavy casualties amongst the Royal Scots. The survivors poured off the hill in considerable confusion. In a fierce counterattack, the battalion's D Company retook the hill at the point of the bayonet, but the Scots were too few in number to withstand repeated regimental-sized Japanese assaults on the hill, and eventually they were forced to retire or face annihilation. The battalion had lost 28 killed on the Golden Hill action. With the fall of the gin drinkers' line, the British had lost their best chance at stopping the Japanese in their tracks and forcing them into static fighting. Overhead, Japanese bombers and fighters constantly attacked the colony's main settlements and the remaining British warships, causing immense damage and great civilian suffering. The British had no way to respond, as the few outdated aircraft at RAF Kai Tak had been destroyed on the ground on the first day of the Japanese offensive. At the Royal Naval Hospital in Wan Chai, Superintending Sister Olga Franklin had organised the relocation of all patients onto wards on the ground floor. The acute, surgical and casualty departments had also been relocated to the ground floor in an effort to prevent casualties from the bombing and shelling. On the morning of the 8th of December, incoming shells awakened the staff and patients. Over the next 2 days, the hospital's upper floors were wrecked by repeated shell and bomb strikes. On the 9th of December, the Chinese staff took flight, looting as much of the hospital gear as they could on the way, recalled Franklin. More shells hit the hospital, shattering windows and doors, as staff took refuge in the strongest part of the building, the pharmacist's door. The hospital's gas, electricity, and water supplies failed. The building was without heating, and sterilizers, kettles, and X-ray machines were no longer functional. Even the emergency water tanks had been holed by shrapnel. Quote, "When one bomb fell right outside Ward 5, shattered window glazing flew in all directions. Plaster, bits of masonry, and parts of wooden shutters clattered onto patients' beds," recalled Sister Franklin. The units holding the west side of the gin drinkers line fell back on the ferries at Tsim Sha Tsui, while the eastern defenders retired via Devil's Peak. Rioting broke out in Kowloon, and looting spread as the British lost control over the panicked Chinese population. Sappers busily destroyed anything in the town of military value and set fire to the massive oil depot, sending huge black smoke clouds high into the air. On the 12th of December, the Royal Navy was ordered to vandalise its own base to deny as much of the facility to the Japanese as possible. Armed with sledgehammers, dynamite and petrol, groups of young sailors and a few soldiers wrecked offices, machine shops and the headquarters vessel HMS Tamar. She was the oldest naval vessel in Hong Kong and had served as China Station headquarters at Kowloon since 1897. The venerable ship was ignominiously scuttled in the harbour. The mainland brigade fought its way to the waterfront through considerable chaos and lawlessness. Lieutenant Colonel R. Cadogan Rawlinson's 5th 7th Rajputs acting as a rearguard, furiously beating back Japanese attempts to get between it and the embarkation points on the quay. A group of Punjabis became separated from their battalion and eventually formed an ad hoc defensive position around the Star Ferry Terminal in Kowloon. The Rajputs fought a final battle on Devil's Peak on the 13th of December, defeating the Japanese, before withdrawing across to the island with the assistance of the few remaining British warships and some fast motor torpedo boats. The Hong Kong Mule Company was forced to abandon most of its animals and escape across the harbour. In 5 days of fighting, Maltby's forces had lost just 66 killed and his army remained intact. Maltby had a few days' grace once the evacuation from the mainland had been completed, before the Japanese would make an amphibious assault across the harbour and onto the island. Japanese aircraft and artillery began to furiously bombard Hong Kong's northern shoreline on the 15th of December, targeting British pillboxes, gun emplacements and communication systems, a process known as softening up. Hospitals were not immune from this general bombardment. Bowen Road Military Hospital and the Royal Naval Hospital at Wan Chai each took over 100 artillery and bomb hits. As the shelling from the mainland began, there were several direct hits on our three-story hospital, recalled Canadian nurse Kay Christie at Bowen Road. We had to immediately evacuate the top two floors and crowd all the patients and equipment into the ground floor area. Unquote. General Sakai made surrender requests to Maltby on the 13th and 17th of December, but these were immediately rejected. The bombardment had wrecked many of Maltby's static defences and killed another 54 men. Maltby rapidly reorganised his forces in preparation for the final assault. Mainland Brigade was renamed East Brigade, and Island Brigade became West Brigade. East Brigade's units were deployed as follows. The Rajputs covered the waterfront, with the Royal Rifles of Canada and Numbers 1, 2 and 3 Companies HKVDC in depth behind. Next to them were the units of the West Brigade, the Punjabis on the waterfront, and the Winnipeg Grenadiers and Numbers 4, 5 and 7 Companies HKVDC behind. The Royal Scots formed a bridge between the two frontline Indian battalions, along with No. 6 Company HKVDC, while the Middlesex Regiment manned the line of pillboxes that studded the north shore of the island. The British had withdrawn three of the four destroyers from Hong Kong just before the Japanese attack. The last remaining destroyer, the 1,075-ton Admiralty S-class HMS Thracian, had its hands full fending off repeated Japanese dive bomber and strafing attacks. Its three QF 4-inch guns and single QF 2-pounder pom-pom trying its best to harass Japanese aircraft. A small number of river gunboats also attempted to fend off repeated Japanese aerial assaults that resulted in several being damaged or sunk. A handful of motor torpedo boats did manage to make several runs through the six battalions of Sakai's 38th Division as it crossed the narrow waters that separated Hong Kong from Kowloon on the night of the 18th of December, inflicting casualties, sinking several landing craft, but also suffering heavily themselves. The MTB assault was more of a nuisance raid than a serious attempt at stopping the Japanese landing. The rest of the world believed that Hong Kong Island was, quote, well protected by a honeycomb of shelters under the peak, unquote, the island's steeply rising gun-encrusted backbone, little realizing that no such fortifications existed. In reality, only the hastily prepared positions thrown up by the Island Brigade would prevent the Japanese from quickly investing the island. The defence rested on under-trained, under-supplied and heavily outnumbered troops, putting up a cohesive resistance through difficult terrain against an enemy riding high on victory and with the sure knowledge of eventual success at the forefront of their minds. On Hong Kong Island, British forces were soon heavily outnumbered by Japanese troops. The 5th, 7th Rajputs was annihilated in hand-to-hand fighting, and the Japanese headlong advance inland was only stopped in this sector by HKVDC, occupying high ground behind the landing zones. But the Japanese did manage to push south to the strategically important Wong Nai Chung Gap. This geographical feature divides Hong Kong Island into two halves. On the 19th, the fight for the gap began in earnest. Private Crabb and the HKVDC's No. 2 Machine Gun Scottish Company found themselves cut off by Japanese patrols probing inland from the landing zones. They fought their first patrol actions in the 19th below Pottinger's Gap. Quote, "It was then that we were introduced to the Japanese mortar, which was extremely accurate, and it was only because of the high percentage of duds that we were not wiped out," recalled Crabb. "We received our first casualties, including myself, slightly wounded, but we gave as good as we got, and they withdrew back to the gap." Unquote. The Wong Nai Chung Gap was defended by Brigadier Lawson's West Brigade Headquarters, No. 3 Company, HKVDC, elements of 5th Anti-Aircraft Battery, Royal Artillery, and some men of the HK and SRA, and Headquarters D Company, Winnipeg Grenadiers. Later in the day, the fighting would suck in the Winnipeg's A Company, the entire Royal Scots, and some Royal Engineers. Lawson lost 451 killed, but he could not stop the Japanese advance. The Japanese intended to slice through the Wong Nai Chung Gap to Repulse Bay and cut Hong Kong Island and the British defences in half. Although Maltby could see what the Japanese were doing, he lacked sufficient supplies and men to counterattack strongly enough to prevent this disastrous outcome. Brigadier Lawson was killed when the Japanese got close enough to assault West Brigade HQ, which was only thinly protected by some Royal Scots. Lawson sent a final message to Maltby by radio saying that he was going outside to, quote, "fight it out," unquote, with the Japanese, and with a service revolver clutched in each fist, he dashed out of his HQ into the thick of the action, where he was quickly cut down and killed. Lawson's chief of staff, Colonel Patrick Hennessy, was also killed, so command of West Brigade devolved to a part-time volunteer officer, Colonel H.B. Rose of the Hong Kong Volunteer Defence Corps. Brigadier Wallace ordered the survivors of East Brigade to reform in the hills north of Stanley. On the 20th of December, the Punjabi's A Company was ordered to relieve the Repulse Bay Hotel, the Japanese having almost succeeded in cutting the island in two. Simultaneously, East Brigade struck west along the same road. The Punjabis made it onto Shonson Hill, but the peak was firmly in Japanese hands. East Brigade was halted at Ucliff. On the same day, Hong Kong's water supply fell into enemy hands when the Japanese captured the island's reservoirs, and the situation appeared dire. The next day, East Brigade tried again and attacked the Wong Nai Chung Gap, but was halted at Red Hill. To the west, three platoons from the Winnipeg Grenadiers managed to retake Mount Butler, but were unable to hold the feature for long. During the battle, 42-year-old Company Sergeant Major John Osborne showed tremendous courage in the face of the enemy, although in a Canadian regiment, Osborne came from Norfolk in England. As A Company was withdrawing off Mount Butler, Osborne single-handedly engaged the Japanese. Quote, "With no regard for his own safety, he assisted and directed stragglers to the new company position, exposing himself to heavy enemy fire to cover this retirement." Unquote. Cut off and later surrounded, Osborne's company was showered with hand grenades by the Japanese. Osborne picked up several and threw them back. Quote, "The enemy threw a grenade which landed in a position where it was impossible to pick it up and return it in time. Shouting a warning to his comrades, this gallant warrant officer threw himself on the grenade, which exploded, killing him instantly. His self-sacrifice undoubtedly saved the lives of many others," unquote, read Osborne's citation for the Victoria Cross. No matter how brave and resourceful the remaining defenders were, the Japanese attack was virtually irresistible. The Middlesex Regiment stabilized the British line on Leyton Hill, preventing the Japanese from taking the waterfront and Victoria, the colony's capital. The Japanese changed their strategy and started forming a bulge in the hills south of the racecourse, Mount Nicholson and Mount Cameron. On the 23rd of December, the Japanese bulge progressed into West Brigade's lines, while East Brigade began to be squeezed into the Stanley Peninsula. Maltby received a final message from Winston Churchill that read, "Every day that you are able to maintain your resistance, you help the Allied cause all over the world." The day before in London, the front page headline of the Daily Express declared in bold black typeface, "Hong Kong Garrison Fight to the Last." The newspaper told its readers that Maltby's gallant command was, not untruthfully, quote, "fighting to the death with swarms of Japanese who landed yesterday at many points on the island, rejected with scorn a third offer of surrender terms, and then came silence," unquote. Private Crabbe's HKVDC unit fell back into the Stanley Peninsula. Quote, "These withdrawals were something we had to get used to, but we were never able to understand the reasons, especially as it seemed as at no time, except at the very end, we were actually forced to retire," unquote. Street fighting continued in Wan Chai throughout Christmas Eve. The Japanese managed to push Maltby's defences in the hills above Central. The 24th found Crabbe's unit well pinned down in the valley by shell and machine gun fire. Our casualties gradually mounted so that the three platoons were getting rather threadbare, he said. Company headquarters was now located in the Stanley Police Station with one platoon on the Chung Hom Kok Peninsula and the rest spread out in the foothills above the village. Quote, "The Japs attacked in strength that night, but we held our lines until midday on Christmas Day. We were now all mixed up," recalled Crabbe. "Middlesex, ourselves, Stanley Jail warders, and elements of the volunteer batteries, all under control of our company commander," unquote. At dawn on Christmas Day, a strong Japanese assault managed to push the Stanley defenders back past the hospital at St. Stephen's College. Whilst the Japanese were murdering and abusing patients and staff inside St. Stephen's College, the remaining troops manning the shortened perimeter at Stanley continued to resist. "By midday, the position was pretty hopeless," said HKVDC Private Crabbe. The company HQ had been wiped out, and control was taken over by an officer who had been in jail up to a few days before. At 3:15 p.m. on Christmas Day, Major General Maltby and the Governor of Hong Kong, Sir Mark Young, agreed to surrender. The Battle of Hong Kong officially ended at 6 p.m. on Christmas Day 1941, when Governor Sir Mark Young signed the instrument of surrender at the Peninsula Hotel in Kowloon. It was the first time in history that a British colony had surrendered to an invading army. Fighting continued on the Stanley Peninsula for a further 11 hours as the defenders were out of contact with higher headquarters. "We pulled back to the hills just overlooking the jail and then were relieved by the Royal Rifles of Canada who had been at Stanley Fort," wrote Private Crabbe. "We were exhausted and retired to the fort to sleep out that night. Next morning, 26th of December, we were advised that the colony had capitulated the previous day and that the Stanley Peninsula area, or what was left of it, had surrendered early that morning," unquote. A quarter of the men in Crabbe's unit had been killed, including the officer commanding and the company sergeant major. But they took some satisfaction from the fact that they had inflicted heavy casualties upon the Japanese. Many Allied veterans of the battle recall that they only lay down their arms when instructed by higher command. "We never gave up," said former Company Sergeant Major George MacDonnell, Royal Rifles of Canada, in 2005. "They had to order us to surrender. If we hadn't run out of bullets, we'd have kept fighting them off for years." In view of the horrific imprisonment these men were to suffer at the hands of the Japanese, such fighting spirit was probably advisable. The defenders had suffered up to 2,400 killed, including wounded soldiers, military medical staff, and an unknown number of civilians who had been massacred by Japanese troops during the advance and after the surrender. Of the 1,975 inexperienced Canadians offered up for sacrifice by Churchill and Brooke Popham, 290 were killed in the fighting and 493 wounded. A further 260 would die in prisoner of war camps in Hong Kong and Japan. Overall, 25% of those taken prisoner in Hong Kong would perish in Japanese labour camps. Britain would not be able to return to China until September 1945, and the liberation of Hong Kong.